BGP Flow Spec was first introduced back in 2009, and since then it's been a very popular way to mitigate the effects of a DDoS attack on organizations with a pretty decent internet presence. So you could sort of think about Flow Spec as a way of distributing a type of firewall functionality into BGP. So in this episode, I'm joined by Justin Ryburn, field CTO at Kentik, who's written extensively about Flow Spec and given talks on it at various conferences. And we're going to get into what it is. What is Flow Spec? How does it work? How is it implemented? And we'll even talk about why it hasn't been adopted quite as much as we expected it to be. My name is Philip Gervasi, and this is Telemetry Now. Justin, it's great to have you back on the podcast. This is not the first time that you're on, so it's great to have you on as a returning guest. Now, I know you personally pretty well, having worked with you for a few years and hung out with you at different events as well. But before we get started with today's episode, we're going to get eyeball deep into BGP Flow Spec. Can you give us a little bit about your background, maybe how you came to your deep understanding of Flow Spec specifically? That would help. And what you're doing now.
Yeah, sure. First of all, thanks for having me on the podcast again, Phil. Happy to be here. Like you said, I have a pretty strong background in service provider. I spent 10 years at Juniper Networks, and one of the projects that I worked on actually about 10 years ago at Juniper was on BGP Flow Spec. My customer at the time, I was working in pre-sales, and they were having to try and figure out a solution around DDoS attacks. They were having quite a few of them that were having a pretty big impact on their customer base, which we'll probably talk about some trends in that at some point here throughout the podcast. But, you know, we're trying to figure out like what's a good solution. They were asking me some questions about BGP Flow Spec. I had heard of it, but didn't know a whole lot about it. So I did a lot of research, reading, did some lab testing, and became, you know, I guess somewhat of an expert. I don't typically like to use the word expert for myself, but, you know, for lack of a better term, I'll use that one. And someone pointed out to me, they're like, there's not much documentation on this. Why don't you document this? So I wrote a day one guide, is what Juniper called it. It kind of, the idea behind those, if folks aren't familiar with them, it's basically a book that, as the name implies, in one day, you can kind of get up to speed on a topic, right? So it's not a full on book, but it's definitely more than a white paper, so somewhere in the middle. So I wrote a day one guide on BGP Flow Spec, did a few public speaking engagements at NANOG and a couple other conferences. We could put some links to in the show notes if people are interested in researching that. But spent a lot of time reading, researching, coming up to speed on Flow Spec, and I've been kind of following it ever since.
Okay, great. Yeah, and for the audience's sake, this episode today sort of spawned from a recent blog post that Justin wrote. I forgot the name of it now. BGP Flow Spec doesn't suck. We're just using it wrong. Is that correct?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay. Something like that. But anyway, it's about BGP Flow Spec, going into the background, what it is from a technical perspective, but also the use case and maybe why it hasn't been adopted as much as we think it should have been or it should have been by now. But ultimately, I do encourage you to go read that because that's a nice way to just sit down and get a good overview if you're not familiar with the technology. So let's start there. What is BGP Flow Spec? And from a technical perspective, of course, like what does it actually do and what do we use it for?
Sure. Yeah. So essentially, it's an extension to the BGP protocol itself. So when the RFC was ratified by the IETF, they expanded BGP by adding a new what's called NLRI, which stands for Network Layer Reachability Information. And in that, we think of NLRIs as like prefixes, IP address prefixes, right? To advertise routes that tell a router how to get from, well, how to get to a destination. And in this specific case, what the IETF expanded BGP to do for Flow Spec in the NLRI was to describe the type of traffic that we want to deny, that we want to, well, that we want to filter, that we want to take an action on, I guess. So if you think of it as like a matching criteria in either a firewall filter or an access list on an interface, the matching criteria is advertised in BGP in that NLRI. So you can do things like destination prefix, source prefix, ports, protocols, TCP flags, packet length. There's a lot of different types of matching criteria that exist in that NLRI.
Okay.
Yeah. And then the next thing that they did was they, you obviously, once you match traffic, you need to be able to say, well, what action do you want to take on that? Right. And the way that they came up with to be able to do that is you attach a community to the route. Similar to the way you would attach a community to a route when you're advertising it for prefixes to tell it, you know, where did this prefix come from? Who advertised it? There's a lot of different reasons or a lot of different ways that people design their communities when they're doing PGP network design. But in this particular case, the communities tell the router what to do, what action to take on that traffic. So the most obvious is just to drop it. Technically, what that means is I'm setting a rate of zero on it. But I can do other things where I can redirect the traffic into a specific VRF. So maybe I'm going to build myself a scrubbing center where I'm going to redirect my traffic to some sort of scrubbing appliance. And I want to put the dirty traffic into one VRF and the clean traffic exists in my global table. So I can redirect it into a VRF. I can change the DSCP markings, the class of service, quality of service markings on it to make the traffic like best effort, for example, so that if I get to a point where there's congestion, then I'll drop that traffic before any of my more important traffic. So there's a few different things that you can do with the matching criteria that are advertised in the community that's attached to the route.
Ultimately, though, it is looking at that information, five-tuple information. It's not doing any kind of like DPI or anything that invasive on traffic, right? So it is a five-tuple.
Yep.
We're matching on traffic, source, destination, port protocol, all that kind of stuff. That's fine. But it's specifically in the BGP update message that it's looking at, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay.
Correct.
All right. So we are focused specifically on that BGP communication between peers or neighbors, whatever you want to call them, in an adjacency. So ultimately, though, when I match some sort of traffic, it's to do something, right? You mentioned firewall, though. Is that the idea behind Flow Spec, that I want to block traffic necessarily? Because otherwise, it's basically kind of like an advanced form of policy-based routing, but specifically for BGP, right?
Yeah, I'm sure there are probably some creative things you could do, you know, to do policy-based routing using FlowSpec. That's not really what it was designed for. That's not really the use case that folks had in mind when they invented the protocol. So the use case that folks had in mind when they designed a protocol was really around DDoS attacks and mitigating those, blocking traffic. So, well, just take the concept we were talking about earlier a step further. When a router receives a BGP flow spec and it looks at the NLRI and says, okay, this is the traffic I want to match, and then it looks at the community and says, this is the action I want to take, that results in essentially the similar concept as an ACL or a firewall filter on the interface. A little bit of a nuanced detail there, and it actually is applied to the forwarding table, not to the interface. So it applies globally on the device unless you exclude certain interfaces. So anyway, point being that traffic that matches that criteria, the action is taken on it. So it basically allows you to kind of dynamically advertise over BGP firewall policies instead of having to log in and configure them manually on the device. So, I mean, back to your original question, I guess, you know, if you really want to get cute and wanted to get creative, you probably could use it for policy-based routing, but I'm not seeing a design like that. And I think it would be something you have to really test well to make sure there weren't any unintended consequences there.
Sure, sure. Well, which to be fair is what we should do with any kind of traffic engineering, right?
For sure.
But basically what you're saying is that the primary use case for FlowSpec, though it can be used for other things, is it's primarily a DDoS mitigation technology, right? So we're going to match on information that we learn in a BGP update message that is indicative of a DDoS attack of some sort, and then we can use FlowSpec to mitigate that attack. So can you explain how that works? And by explain how it works, you're going to have to get in a little bit about how DDoS works for our audience as well, I think.
I think that you're going to have some sort of way to know what the parameter of the attack is. Right. And so whether you're going to do a manual mitigation, like logging in and configuring an ACL or a firewall filter on your device, or you're going to do what's called a remote trigger black hole, which is also a PGP advertisement. But what a remote trigger black hole does is it just completely takes that host offline. So if I have a /32, a given host that's under attack, and I do a remote trigger black hole, I basically just say to my router, any packets that come in that are destined to that IP address, just drop them on the floor, right? Just route them to null zero, just drop them on the floor, which there's a term called completing the attack, meaning that if that host was under attack, it was already performing poorly, But in theory, it was kind of up. Some packets were, you know, some legitimate packets were getting through, some attack packets were getting through. If I use a remote trigger black hole, it's completely offline now, right? So FlowSpec at least helps make that better in that I can get more surgical, I can get more granular in what it is that I'm trying to attack to filter without having to manually log in and configure firewall filters on the interface. But again, like I said at the top of that comment, you have to have some way to know what the parameters of the attack are and what you're trying to mitigate. So presumably you're going to have some sort of monitoring system that tells you, hey, you're under attack and here's the parameters of the attack. Here's what your source and dest IPs and ports and protocols and all that kind of five tuple type of stuff looks like so that you can then in turn create the FlowSpec rule.
So since FlowSpec is integrated into BGP and BGP is inherently very scalable, right? That's one of the benefits of BGP. Then therefore FlowSpec is also very scalable. And that's as opposed to like manually configuring ACL rules on interfaces or deploying firewalls or IDS, IPS appliances everywhere. I mean, FlowSpec, again, because it operates within the context of BGP, is therefore inherently a very scalable solution to mitigate against DDoS attacks, which also can be very broad in their scope, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's one of the, I guess the, you know, the pros and cons. Well, the main reason that people really pushed for the protocol to begin with is doing a manual firewall filter on interface works really well, but it requires that somebody either manually logs in and configures that filter on the interface, or you develop some sort of automation script that takes care of it for you. It requires a lot of work on the operator side. The idea behind FlowSpec is we can take that same, pros that we get out of being able to do very granular filters and advertise it out in a very dynamic way. And keep in mind, we're kind of talking here in the context of advertising it to one device. But if I am a global service provider and I have hundreds of edge nodes, I can create one BGP route on something like a route server, and it'll advertise it out to all 100 of my edge nodes, right? As opposed to having to log into each one of them manually, or again, push out a script that makes that configuration and so forth.
Yeah. And that's where I was going with the whole scalability thing. So that makes sense. So does that mean that in your experience and maybe in your opinion as well, it really is more of a service provider technology than it is for like a large enterprise technology? Because if I'm running a large enterprise with a lot of peerings, wouldn't I be putting that FlowSpec information in my community, BGP community information that I'm then advertising back upstream to my service provider? So that's a whole nother world of trust relationships and how that works.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. So, I guess the first thing I'll say is that, we as an industry, we talk about like service provider enterprises, like they're two completely different beasts, right? And the reality is it's sort of all a bit of a grayscale, right? Yes, it's true that enterprises build networks for different purposes most times than service providers do, right? Service providers build a network to sell as a service. Enterprises typically build a network to service their end users, their applications, right? But we work with a lot of, I work here at Kentik with a lot of enterprises that are building, I'll call them service provider type networks, right? These could be gaming networks. It could be high frequency trading networks. They're every bit as critical to the mission of that organization as the service provider's network is to them, right? And at very similar scales, right? I mean, Google, who probably runs one of the biggest networks in the world, is technically an enterprise. If you think about it, they're not a service provider. They don't sell their network per se, right? But they're operating a huge scale network. So anyway, the lines are a little blurry between service provider and enterprise when you think of it from that perspective. But if you're operating a large scale internet connected network, regardless of what your business model is, then having something like this is super critical to your network, right? And to being able to keep your network online, being able to scale out these, and block these type of attacks and keep the network running.
Yeah. And then, blocking these kind of like large scale attacks it's going to be something that has to be like vendor agnostic. And we are talking about an industry standard. I did look at the RFC. It's RFC 5575 from 2009-ish, which is relatively new. I mean, some people might consider it old.
There's actually, it's interesting in researching and for that latest blog that I did, it turns out they actually just ratified a new one. It's now RFC 8955.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting.
Which replaced the previous one that was about 12 or 13 years old. So it's actually, the protocol itself has been around quite a while, but there's been some advancements to it over the years and some, you know, lessons learned and some testing that's been done. And so there's a new RFC that's been ratified that addresses some of those things.
Okay. And so being an industry standard then, it is not a vendor specific technology. It is not proprietary to Cisco or to Juniper or to Arista or anyone for that matter. But does that mean that the implementation is pretty similar among those vendors? Like if I were a service provider or a larger enterprise looking to mitigate DDoS attacks and the ramifications of those DDoS attacks, I should say, right? Can I, and I'm running a multi-vendor network, can I look at FlowSpec as a solution?
Yeah, it is multi-vendor. It's not proprietary to any one vendor. I would say that, you know, the thing that to keep in mind, though, is that the resulting filter that we talked about earlier is implemented in hardware, right? It's implemented in the chip. So the one thing you would need to make sure is that whatever chipset, the line cards from whatever vendor you have are running, are capable of that. Now, you know, in 2024, or even your commodity ASICs from places like Broadcom and so forth, even they have support for PGP FlowSpec. It's been around long enough that they're starting to add in support in a lot of those. So odds are pretty good if you're running a fairly large scale network to the point where you're having these type of problems that FlowSpec would help you with, large attacks and a lot of distributed edge, internet edge type of connectivity. Odds are pretty good whatever you're buying has the support for it built right in.
Okay. So let's say that we have some rules and in our FlowSpec implementation and the rules match and it fires off some sort of action, like you said. What are the kinds of actions that I would take on traffic that that triggers one of those rules? I mean, obviously you mentioned one is just black hole the traffic. That's one. And that's obvious, I think. But what are some other actions that we would take specifically for a DDoS attack?
Yeah, the only two I've really seen implemented in practice is, you know, dropping the traffic and then redirecting it to, like I said, a scrubbing service. And so what some companies will do is they'll, you know, have like, I don't know, let's call it two data centers, one on the East Coast and one on the West Coast of the United States, if they're a US operator or, you know, or something similar globally. And they will have, you know, scrubbing appliances from a DDoS vendor, or they'll have routers whose purpose built to do scrubbing of attack traffic or whatever. And so on their edge devices, they'll basically just put any traffic that's matching the criteria into a dirty VRF, is what they'll call it. You know, I mean, for lack of a better term, that traffic will then get sent over to the scrubbing service in the scrubbing center that they've built in those data centers that they've built. They'll scrub the traffic out and then re-inject it back into their global table. Mm-hmm. And so one of the matching criteria you can do in one of those communities is to tell it any traffic that matches this, basically stick it into this VRF. Basically, back to your point about it's kind of like a policy-based routing type of action that you're taking on that traffic. So it's still the use case for that is still for mitigating traffic. It's just you're not mitigating it right there on the device. You're redirecting it somewhere else to be inspected a second time to go deeper into the packet potentially, or find more creative. Keep in mind, this entire conversation has been sort of predicated on the concept of volumetric attacks.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
If the type of attack that you have is like a TCP send that's filling up the session tables on a server. Sometimes those can be what they call slow and low attacks, where they're not high volume. They're just sending in like a really small send packet. So they're kind of hard to catch from a volumetric perspective. But redirecting that to a scrubbing service, they might have a DPI appliance in it that can look farther into the packet and figure out that, oh yeah, this is in fact, you know, a slow and low attack, you know, might allow you to mitigate something that just a router and FlowSpec's not going to like.
Okay. So we're looking at a lot of stuff here. We are looking at source and destination IP. We're looking at protocols and ports. We are looking at TCP flags as well, right? So we can actually get pretty granular in our filtering for whatever reason, whether it's for filtering and traffic engineering or for mitigating DDoS attacks or any other kind of nefarious activity. You can get pretty granular again within the context of the BGP updates. So let's talk about the adoption rate. You know, that was 9 years ago that you gave that talk at NANOG, and in that Talk, which I just watched, I think, yesterday and then a little bit earlier today, you were talking about the adoption rate and how it's kind of slow and not going, quickly. It's not going as much as we thought it would be, considering the rise in DDoS attacks. Why do you think that is? And where are we at today in 2024?
Yeah, it's really hard to get a good handle on that. There's not been a lot of great research done on that, at least not that I've come across. If any of the listeners have come across something, please send it my way. I'd love to see some data on this. I've Googled around, not been able to find much as far as research on that. I'll just say somewhat anecdotally from talking to our customers, here at Kintiq about it, definitely a lot more questions about it with every passing year. There seems to be a lot more people testing it in their labs, starting to roll it out inside of their own networks. So there definitely seems to be, some traction coming with it. I just think it's one of those things, a lot like IPv6, where it's been around for a long time, but adoption is very slow, right? Change takes time, okay. Especially when we're talking about the internet. We're talking about networks that aren't under any single one person's control. Mm-hmm. We move as quick as things change in this industry. Adoption of things actually happened very slowly in this industry is kind of what I have found.
Yeah, I think I get
PGP
that.
Flow spec is no different than anything else when it comes to that.
I mean, the only thing I would say to that is I wonder if the adoption is slow for a particular technology in tech because the urgency isn't there. Otherwise, the adoption will be much quicker. Like, for example,
that's fair.
And I'm going to get in big trouble for saying this, but most organizations don't have a burning need, an urgency that things are going to go down if they don't migrate to an entirely IPv6 network. And so they run dual stack or just IPv4. And we have NAT and things to accommodate. I wonder if it's the same for FlowSpec. Are there alternatives that can mitigate DDoS attacks and other kind of security threats as effectively?
Yeah. I mean, like I said earlier, I alluded to one earlier, which is, you can build scripts. So, you can build, it takes a pretty decent programmer. I know you and I both communicate in some automation forums where, specifically the network automation forum, where they're really trying to get the practice of network automation up and to the right and more people adopting it. That's a use case for that type of thing, right? Building out an automation framework and maybe even a web portal where people can go in and put in the parameters of the attack. And it would then in turn, build some Python script or some Ansible scripts or something that would then push the firewall filter out and would log into the device and configure the firewall device through automation. So there are some other ways to accomplish this. There are some other ways to get around it. And I'm sure there are organizations that have figured that out. There are other, for a lot of enterprises, they can actually buy a DDoS service, right? There are companies, some of which are, partners of Kintiq that provide DDoS scrubbing as a service. And typically the way those work is you'll either have an always on service where you route your traffic through them and they're constantly keeping an eye on your traffic and mitigating it. If they see an attack, they're basically inline. I mean, it's basically like a DPI service, right? Increases your latency a little bit, like anything. There's engineering trade-offs for that. You can do what's called on demand, where basically once you're under attack, you swing the traffic over to them. They advertise your BGP routes on the internet on your behalf, swing the traffic into their scrubbing service, scrub the traffic out, and then return the clean traffic to you. So there are, again, a number of different ways to try and solve this problem. As with anything, each one of them kind of has their own pros and cons. And so I think, to your point, that's probably part of the reason that, it's not 100% of every organization is doing BGP flow spec, because they may have different, trade-offs that they've made and different ways to approach the problem.
I get it. And it's like a tool in an engineer's toolbox, like we say about so many technologies. Maybe it's the familiarity of the staff with FlowSpec or, it's already in existence. And so the organization continues with it. It's just another tool. But let's talk about a couple of the problems that have happened due to a FlowSpec implementation that maybe led to a reluctance among some engineers to deploy it. Like, for example, I see here in our notes that there were some outages at CenturyLink and Cloudflare. As a result of FlowSpec.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, that definitely can't be ignored as far as a reason that there's been some reluctancy to adopt FlowSpec. In fact, I've had conversations with people that's the number one reason why they have some reluctancy to, right? especially when Flow Spec was new and not a lot of folks had adopted it and not a lot was known about, you know, the pros and cons and best practices. It hadn't had nearly as much lab testing. There are some pretty visible outages as a result of it. I'm not going to pick on Cloudflare, but that's the one I think that's top of mind for most people when this comes up, because it was a very visible outage. In that particular outage, they have an entire blog on their website about it. As Cloudflare normally does, they used it as an opportunity to share what they learned with the industry and did a really nice kind of blameless postmortem on it that folks can go and read. But, they had some automation in place, and they had advertised a flow spec rule that said to block any packets from 99,971 to 99,985 bytes long. Now, for those who are listening who are network engineers, the words I just used make no sense. Like, you can't have a packet that size. That's above the maximum, you know, MTU on pretty much any link in any network, right? So that doesn't actually make any sense. And the way that they happen to have Juniper devices in their network, and the way that the Juniper line cards reacted to getting a flow spec rule that told them to do that was they rebooted, right? They didn't know what to do. Really? So they had a panic in the software and they rebooted, which made the outage worse. Now, I would argue Juniper's devices shouldn't have reacted that way to an invalid packet size. But on the flip side, you know, it's one of those things as a network engineer, as a network automation person, you want to check your fields to make sure that you're not advertising a value that doesn't make any sense. It's no different than trying to, you know, put an IP address that's more than 32 bit into a field, right? I mean, those aren't just numbers. They have some meaning, right? Same type of thing on the packets. So, that was very obviously very unfortunate for Cloudflare. And a lot of people saw that and said, well, you know, this is a big hammer. I want to be careful using this tool because it's a big hammer. So I think it definitely caused the protocol itself to kind of get a bit of a black eye for sure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you look at the configuration of FlowSpec, and I'm most familiar with Cisco, I know you're a former Juniper, but I'm going to stick with Cisco because that's what I know. You are creating class maps. You're matching on addresses and prefixes. You're writing policy maps. This is very reminiscent of policy-based routing, right? Mm-hmm. You know, there's the community that you're writing and incorporating that into. So that's all kind of manual and pieces that can easily be messed up by a human being engineer. And then propagated to your provider or to peers and things like that. So I understand how that there is a potential for a problem in a blast radius, but that is a human problem. It's not it's not a problem with the technology, is it? I mean, it's not like the technology is ineffective. We shouldn't use it. Like it's lacking in some way, like RIP versus, you know, OSPF or something like that. It's a problem with human beings implementing it.
Yeah. And that's long been sort of my argument. Like two people who bring that to my attention when I'm involved in the conversation is, I mean, that's the same with most technologies that we adopt, right? It needs to be tested well. You need to lab test it, understand what the, you know, what the pros and cons are, where the rough edges are and so forth. But a lot of that is like you said, a human problem, human error problem, or things that we can very easily build best practices or build scripts or build policies and config best practices and so forth to avoid, having those negative impacts. And the benefits to me, if you're the kind of person who, like at one point in my career, I was dealing with DDoS attacks on a daily basis, you know, if that's the world you're living in and it provides you with some positive benefit to make this much quicker and much easier to mitigate, then, you know, it's probably worth going through the hassle or the trouble to figure out what best practices you want to build around that and what policies and so forth you want to build to make sure that you can do it in a way that doesn't cause outages in your network.
And I don't know if I'd even use the term hassle or trouble, because it is part of how we do networking. I mean, everything that we do in networking is very impactful. It's not like migrating some back-end server where you have, you know, other servers that can take up the workload and things like that. You wiggle the wrong wire, you could take down an entire location. You know, hopefully you have some kind of path redundancy.
I think we all have stories where we've done that on accident, right? If you've been doing this long enough.
Yeah. I mean, It obviously, if you are wiggling a wire and take down an entire site, there's probably a designed issue that needs to be addressed. Like, why is that entire site based on? Anyway, whatever we do in networking is typically very impactful right down to the end user. And that's really what I mean by impactful. So that's why I like to say, you know, best practices aren't a trouble or a hassle, but they're just part of our workflow. You know,
they're part of good engineering and good network design.
Engineering. Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So let's get into that a little bit more. So, you know, I describe, at least on Cisco devices, and I assume on other vendors as well, you know, you're writing class maps and matching addresses and policy maps, and there's probably ACLs in there that you're referring to. I'm not exactly sure. So there's a manual process to writing out your flow spec implementation. What are some of the best practices then that an organization, that engineers can take when implementing flow spec?
Yeah, this is a conversation I have quite frequently with customers. And the things that I tend to advise people on is make sure you know what the forwarding performance impacts are to your line cards, right? It's typically not zero, right? What is resulting from that flow spec advertisement, like you said, is a some sort of firewall rule or some sort of ACL. Each chipset's going to implement it slightly different than the way they do it. But you're taking up a resource on that chip, right? And the chip's primary function is the forward traffic, as we all know, right? These are routers. That's what routers route. That's what they're designed to do. So, I know the Juniper architecture the best because I spent a lot of years there. They advertise 16,000 flow spec routes in the current, in the generation of chips that they were making when I was there. Now that's been know, 7 years ago. So it may have gone up from that, but the catch there that's unidirectional. That's if that card is doing nothing else. As you get close to that number, you will see a forwarding performance impact. So I advise people, if you're going to try and push the limits of what the vendor states is the limit on the number of flow spec rules that they can support, make sure you do it with some sort of test set running packets through that line card and figure out what it's port. You know, if it can forward at line rate 10 gig with no flow spec rules, and you start at, you know, ramping up the number of flow spec rules, at what point can you only get 8 gig through, or can you only get 7 gig? You know, what is your forwarding performance so that you can stay, you know, under that limit? Also, not all flow spec rules are created equal. And that may seem obvious when I explain this, but if you have a really simple rule that only matches on a /32 and doesn't have any ports or protocols or TCP flags or anything in it, that's going to take up a lot less resources on your line card than a more complex one that does have all those type of things, right? So when you're thinking about how you're going to do this in your network design, the simpler that you can make your flow spec rules and still accomplish what you're trying to filter, the better, right? Because it'll take up less resources and it'll scale a lot better.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So those are a couple of things I always recommend that people test and check and just make sure. The other thing that you mentioned a couple of times, I wanted to clarify. I've seen most people in this industry that will advertise BGP FlowSpec IGP throughout their own ASN, the network that they have under their own command. There are some carriers out there that will accept flow spec rules from their downstream customers, from their enterprise customers. It's very rare. That seems to be where people kind of draw the line as an industry, as far as, you know, risk and you know, concerns about the protocol and so forth, is interdomain routing. It's like, I'm happy to do it inside of my own network where I can control everything. I can control all the devices, but allowing my customers to advertise them to me, that's where people tend to get a little nervous about things. So if that's what you're thinking about, if you're an enterprise and that's what you're thinking about doing, you might want to call your carrier and make sure that that's something that they accept and see if there's any upgrade to your, you know, contracts for your circuits that you have to do to be able to send them flow spec rules. Cause that is kind of rare that they allow that.
Okay. That makes sense. So does that mean that flow spec rules are, or rather the incoming traffic that the flow spec implementation is looking at, is that running in CPU like old school policy-based routing, or is it running off of hardware, off the ASIC?
Every router I'm aware of is doing this in hardware, right? And I think that, you know, a couple things. One, that's why, back almost 10 years ago when I did that talk at Nanog, there was somewhat limited vendor support for it. It was basically just Juniper, Cisco, and I think Nokia at the time, right? Because it was done in silicon. It was done in custom silicon. Your Broadcom commodity ASICs didn't support it. Like I mentioned, that most of those newer Broadcom chips are supporting this. So people like Arista and some other vendors who are using commodity ASICs are now supporting it. So it's got a lot broader support than it did years ago. But yeah, it is done in hardware, so it does scale much better. You wouldn't want, I would think you probably wouldn't want to do this if it were done in software. It just would be a non-starter because it would have too much impact on your devices.
I mean, in theory. And I say that because I know that is the idea, right? That we don't want to punt that sort of filtering processing to the CPU to look at and to do. Mm-hmm. But I have done that reluctantly in deployments in the past, and the impact on the CPU is generally minimal unless you're seeing a very high volume of traffic. However, we are talking about service providers and aggregation routers and things like that. So,
and it's volumetric probably different. Attacks too.
And volumetric attacks. So it is different. So you want to spare any kind of processing by the CPU on unnecessary tasks as much as you can. So where are we today with the development around FlowSpec? Maybe what does the adoption look like today in 2024? What can folks do to be active in the community? Maybe even in the community looking at how we can mitigate DDoS attacks in general. So where can folks go? What can they look at? What can they read?
Yeah, sure. So like I mentioned earlier, the IETF has a more recent ratification of the draft, that RFC 8955. That falls under the Interdomain Routing Working Group, which maintains all things BGP, including BGP FlowSpec. So folks can go and sign up for that mailing alias, read about some of the conversations that are taking place there as folks are starting to roll this out and test it and so forth. That's where they go to ask questions or come up with things that they've run into that are challenges that might require a change to the protocol itself. You know, a couple things that I know are recurring themes just from having snooped that alias a little bit is like, how do we do all this with IPv6, right? That requires some slightly different communication in the protocols and so forth. A lot of the vendors, I alluded to it earlier, but a lot of the vendors have added in the ability to exclude certain interfaces. So for example, I know Cisco allows you to go in and say, okay, when I configure to allow FlowSpec, I have an interface group that I want to accept that was probably like my management interface, like if I have an out-of-band management interface, I don't want to apply firewall, BGP FlowSpec rules to that. If I have interfaces that are, I don't know, voice, go to my voice network or go to certain networks that I are internal only that I don't want, that it wouldn't make sense to ever apply a filter to, I can exclude those so that they'll never be included in a filter, no matter what the matching criteria is on the filter. So there's a few things like that that are implementation details that people have learned over the years, and they're contributing those learnings back to the community by being a part of the IETF working group and the mailing alias there. You know, I would say go to industry events. I know, Phil, you and I participate in the NU, the NUGs, the network user groups that the USNUA puts on. Those are a good place to meet peers if you're running enterprise networks, if you're running large service providers, like a lot of your NANOGs, your RIPES, your apricots. There's a lot of different industry events that those folks put on. Those are great places to get out and talk to other people and ask them, hey, are you doing FlowSpec? What have you seen? You know, what have you run into, good, bad, and otherwise? You know, that's where I've learned a lot about over the years, is just talking to people at those events and kind of picking their brain on what they've seen.
So Justin, for the sake of time, I think we're going to end it here. And it's interesting, though, the timing of this particular episode, because not long ago, I recorded a podcast with Andrew Sullivan, the president of the Internet Society. And he or his organization actually, in their analysis, found that there's an uptick right now in DDoS attacks. I don't know what scale he was referring to, whether that was North America or the Internet as a whole, a global scale. But nevertheless, I'm sure how to mitigate the effects of a DDoS attack are top of mind for a lot of people right now. So really interesting timing. Thanks so much for joining today. Now, if folks have a question for you, if they have a comment and they'd like to reach out to you, how can they find you online?
Yeah, I check LinkedIn more so than any other social media. So I'm just Justin Ryburn. That's spelled RYBURN on LinkedIn. I am still on Twitter, X, whatever we're calling it these days, but I don't check that nearly as often. Or people are welcome to email me. I'm just jryburn@kintic.com.
Great. Thanks very much, Justin. And I am still active on Twitter at @network_Phil. My LinkedIn, you can just search my name, Philip Gervasi. My personal blog, networkphil.com, but certainly also check out both Justin's blogs and my blog posts on the Kentik blog. Now, if you have an idea for an episode, or if you'd like to be a guest on Telemetry Now, I'd love to hear from you. You can email us at telemetrynow@kentik.com. So for now, thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.